ETF Prime is hosted by investment advisors of the ETF Store. This program is for informational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice. Investing in ETFs involves risk, including potential loss of principal. Any past performance figures discussed are not necessarily indicative of future results. The ETF Store is not affiliated with ETF.com or any of its affiliates. ETF.com's participation in this program should not be construed as an endorsement or an indication by ETF.com of the value of any ETF Store product or service. Visit ETFstore.com for more information.
Now it's time for ETF Prime, where we discuss everything you need to know about exchange-traded funds and the world of investing. Whether you're an investing expert or just starting out, Nate and Jason will help you get up to date on what's happening on Wall Street and show you how exchange-traded funds can help lower your investment costs, reduce your tax bill, and allow you to take advantage of investment opportunities around the world. And now, the host of ETF Prime, Nate Geraci.
Welcome to ETF Prime, Nate Geraci and Jason Lank in studio. As always, thank you so much for joining us. We have a fantastic show lined up today. On the program will be Chuck Self, Chief Investment Officer at iSectors. iSectors is what's called an ETF strategist. So they run a suite of 16 primarily ETF-based model portfolios. These portfolios have some $260 million invested in them. And Chuck himself has over 30 years of experience managing investments. He's actually managed multi-billion dollar portfolios. We're going to focus in on the financial markets with Chuck today. Of course, when you oversee 16 portfolios, as Chuck does, you tend to have a pretty good handle on everything that's going on. Jason, it's actually been a little while since we've talked financial markets, which I guess in some ways is how we like it, right? Keep a longer term perspective. But there's no shortage of things to discuss right now. You have U.S. stocks near all-time record highs. We've seen the yield curve flattening out. There's been quite a bit of turmoil in emerging markets, which are now down over 20% from their peak earlier this year. Of course, there's also a lot going on politically in the U.S., which I'm not sure we want to wade too deep into that. But it's been an interesting year, certainly much more so than last year.
It has been an interesting year. And most of the people listening are United States citizens, a few around the world, but most of them are U.S. centric. So U.S. stocks being up, that's a good thing for most investors. But certainly the shape of the returns this year has been very different than last year. And you're right, so many headlines seemingly daily, much more volatility. And we may touch on this a little later in the show. Good news stocks are up, but the depth and the breadth of the trading within the various indices is very different. And so maybe we'll touch on that later in the show.
Yeah. Also, later in the program, we'll be joined by ETF.com's Laura Krieger. We're going to discuss perhaps the hottest area in the financial markets right now, which is marijuana stocks. As a matter of fact, the marijuana ETF, the ETFMG Alternative Harvest ETF, that's been one of the top performing ETFs over the past month. It's up 30+%. And I've got to say, you talk about a fascinating space. There are just so many things occurring here right now. You have acquisitions, big alcohol companies getting involved, THC-infused beers, a whole slew of new companies launching. Obviously, you have all of the sort of regulatory overhang and legal considerations. I kind of wonder if this is what it was like back in the early 1930s before the end of prohibition on alcohol. It just feels like we're maybe heading the same direction here with marijuana.
There is an absolute euphoria in this space. Of course, the legalization in Canada.
That's a big driver for sure.
Absolutely. And then, of course, in our country, you know, legislation, various states at various levels of legality. You know, this is certainly, a budding investment opportunity.
But, you can't help the puns.
Absolutely. But it feels, you're right, like a gold rush almost. And to that analogy, think back to the 1800s. A lot of the gold miners didn't make a lot of money, but Levi Strauss sure did, selling things to the gold miners. So where the dollars end up and who are the winners and losers, nobody knows for sure yet. But to your point, Nate, about the speed of change and the pace of what's happening from an investor standpoint, from a user standpoint, and from a regulatory standpoint. It's just every day there's a new headline.
Yeah, this should be a really interesting conversation with Laura, who's really been all over this entire story over the past year. As always, if you have questions or comments, you can find me on Twitter, at Nate Geraci, or you can visit etfprime.com. So as I mentioned, we are going to focus on the financial markets in the first half of the show today. And let me first start with a quick recap of returns so far this year, just looking at some broad asset classes. The S&P 500, so large cap U.S. stocks, they're up nearly 9%, as I mentioned, currently pushing record highs. Small cap U.S. stocks are up over 11%. And then looking internationally, developed international stocks are down 5%. And emerging market stocks are down over 10%. On the bond side of the equation, broad-based U.S. bonds are down 1.5%. Intermediate-term U.S. treasuries are down over 2%. High-yield bonds are up 2%. Broad-based international bonds are down close to 3%. And emerging market bonds are down nearly 7%. And then lastly, gold is down over 7%. REITs are up 2%. And broad-based commodities are about flat on the year. I'm also going to toss in Bitcoin as well. We do talk cryptos on the show, so to be fair, Bitcoin has been absolutely bludgeoned this year. It's down over 50%. But Jason, bottom line is, it's still pretty much U.S. stocks and not much of anything else.
I think that is the headline that we'll talk about with Chuck perhaps later on. The U.S. stocks are leading the parade, and you know, I can't complain too much about that. A balanced, diversified U.S. Investors' portfolio is up, despite some of the headlines and the political climate and the volatility and some of the other asset classes that have not fared as well. But that brings up a challenge that when we see headlines like U.S. stocks being up, in a nice way, most investors' portfolios will not be up the same amount because they're going to be diversified. They're going to have various asset classes for all the reasons that we talk about on this show. And so there's a little bit of a paradox there. You see the good news and you see the U.S. stocks, but why is my portfolio a little bit underneath that? And we all know the answer to that. There's always going to be an indice, an asset class that outperforms your portfolio, and there are going to be many that underperform it. That's part of investing. You never want to get all the lows, and the price for that is you're never going to get the highs. That's okay. So good news, U.S. stocks are doing okay. But certainly, we want to keep our eye on some of the other asset classes, certainly foreign securities right now.
All right. So this month marks the 10-year anniversary of really the depths of the global financial crisis. Hard to believe that was 10 years ago. But you think back to September 2008, you had the collapse of Lehman Brothers. The U.S. government was scrambling to prop up Fannie and Freddie. Merrill Lynch sold to Bank of America. AIG was getting bailed out. We could go on and on. This was really the crescendo of the financial crisis. But of course, since that time, stocks bottomed in March of 2009, and the S&P 500 has now more than quadrupled over the past 9-plus years. So here we are. U.S. stocks are at record highs. And obviously the question is, what's next? And I bring up the financial crisis because all the way as stocks have gone up, we've had these perma bears, fear mongers, just waiting for the other shoe to drop, saying the world is going to come to an end. And actually in Barron's over the weekend, they highlighted how some individual investors have missed significant returns just because the scars from the financial crisis ran so deep, right? They stayed out of the markets. Barron's actually referenced a survey from Betterment, which, listen to this. They found 48% of the 2,000 people surveyed thought the stock market had not gone up at all over the past 10 years, and 18% actually said it had gone down. I mean, that's just mind-boggling. But, I would say on the other hand, I think with where we're at now, anytime you have stocks quadrupling, you're going to have some people throwing around words like bubble. There's going to be debate over valuations. I guess my point is, it's sort of an odd situation here. I mean, we have people arguing over whether this is the longest bull market in history. We have news headlines coming out every day that you really just can't make up. I mean, I got to tell you, I shudder to open up Twitter every morning. This is an odd environment.
It is an odd environment. What's changed? There are Well, there are certain buzzwords in our industry that you have to be careful with. Always, never, certainly the G word, guaranteed, and of course, this time is different. Is this time different? You know, that's a trap we can get into. I don't know that history repeats itself, but it certainly rhymes. There are three, I'll throw my hat in the ring, really three areas that I think of that certainly are very different than it used to be, and whether that manifests itself in investment returns, I don't know, but certainly the political climate has changed. It's very different. We have a different kind of president, regardless of what side of the aisle you sit on, and our president bypasses media and speaks directly to citizens via Twitter. That's brand new. That's amazing. That's really different. And on the subject of Twitter and Facebook and Google and Periscope, social media has absolutely changed how we communicate and how we get our information. There are studies out there that millennials in particular don't read a newspaper, don't have magazine subscriptions, maybe a digital one. But it's YouTube, it's Facebook, and how they get their information is absolutely changing.
Well, and it's in real time.
Absolutely.
Up to the second.
The news cycle,
I think that's the point.
The news cycle is no longer overnight. It's to the minute. So, interesting. The third one, certainly, we'll talk about more in our next segment, is the central bank intervention. We saw never before seen monetary policies 10 years ago at the depth of the crisis. And since we've never seen that type of program, quantitative easing at that level, we've also never seen it unwound. So those three areas, I think, are a little different in terms of today's climate.
Well, you and I were talking a lot about this last week because there was an article from CNBC that caught both of our attention. It was titled, J.P. Morgan's Top Quant Warns Next Crisis to Have Flash Crashes and Social Unrest Not Seen in 50 Years. And look, anyone who listens to the show knows we try to stay away from headlines like this. But what was interesting was this quant, his name is Marco Kalanovich. CNBC calls him the man who moves the markets. He raised several concerns about how the world and markets have evolved since the financial crisis and how he thinks that could exacerbate the next recession. And to be clear, he wasn't making a prediction. This was more conveying concerns he has about how things have changed over the past 10 years. But he said the rise in computerized trading, right? So algos, high frequency traders, along with the rise in passive investing could result in significant flash crashes. And he mentioned how the 1600 point drop in the Dow back in February and the 1100 point decline in August of 2015, those occurred during a bull market. So his point was, what happens if we're in the midst of a recession? And, with the computerized trading strategies, I think what he was getting at is these all have similar sell points, and many of these strategies trade passive products. And I also think on the passive side, his point was investors will all head for the exits at the same time, or maybe you just don't have as many active investors stepping in to take advantage if the market does decline. But on top of all that, to what you were hitting on, talking about central banks, he says if we have a significant crash, he doesn't think central banks have enough ammo to help stem the tide because they've expended so much after the financial crisis. So, the question is, I think, again, what you were getting at is have things changed? Are things different?
Maybe. I'll give it a definite maybe. But what caught my eye about this article is the fact that J.P. Morgan didn't trot out their summer intern to give an op-ed. This is their top quant guy. So you take notice. A lot of financial press is positive. Much less to a lesser degree do you see the kind of doomsday sort of stuff. And from J.P. Morgan on CNBC, that rings a bell for me, just a little one. But to your point about the central bank intervention, let me take the other side a little bit on a few of these and maybe offer some perspective. I think most people would agree that, number one, it was unprecedented, but two, we did avoid Armageddon. I mean, we were in some quarters that my sources say we were a few weeks away from ATM cards not working if somebody had not done something. So that, I think I would agree that this is unprecedented. Have the seeds been sown for the next crisis because of the last one? Maybe. That remains to be seen. This process of winding this down has only just begun. Now, when he talks about the computerized trading strategies, first off, computer trading strategies, the high-frequency guys, have been around for years. And one of the things that happens is that if any side of the trade gets a little crowded, someone will find the other side. I mean, this is game theory to the nth degree, right? I mean, there was always a race to equilibrium in that. So could initially some sides of the trades get crowded? Sure. But somebody's going to want to make a buck on the other side. So I'm not quite sure about that. The last point, though, the passive investing, I think that's the least credible argument. I tend to see the arguments, the predictions, the negative predictions about passive investing coming from people that tend to stand to lose the most, you know, the active management, the quants, and those sort of guys. So a little grain of salt there. But two, just the reality is that the amount of worldwide assets managed in a passive manner is so small. It's just it. I don't want to say it doesn't move the needle, but it's just not at a place where we're at anywhere near a tipping point.
Yeah, I think in the U.S. right now, it's at about 14 or 15% of overall of the overall equity market, and much less than that just in terms of trading volume.
Absolutely. So I really appreciate this article, and I appreciate the source, but I think you have to take a balanced approach. If what he's talking about were to occur, these are certainly tail events, not something that's impossible to happen, but I think pretty far out there.
Well, we need to take a break. Here's what I'll say. I think if there's one thing that Marko Kalanović mentioned that I do feel like is a legitimate concern, it's sort of the changing social dynamics in this country. So Marko said in his report, quote, "The next crisis is also likely to result in social tensions similar to those witnessed 50 years ago in 1968, which, of course, that was during the Vietnam War. There were the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Senator Kennedy. For me, I guess the way that I would frame this is over the past decade, the markets have quadrupled, right? The economy has come back. But the fact is, not everyone has participated. We have concerns over rising wealth inequality in this country. I think there are a decent chunk of people who feel like they've missed out. And so, you know, I don't think there's any question that's contributed to the political climate in the country. And I think it's fair to, you know, it's fair to ask what would happen if we do have a significant market crash.
To your point earlier that you made, Nate, about, you know, the millions of Americans don't understand the market has gone up or didn't participate or both. And if there were to be a significant market correction and they get the downside, but they never got the upside since the Great Recession, you get enough dissatisfied people together. That is a recipe for change. So we'll have to see how it unfolds.
Yeah. And let's be clear. We're not saying, you know, any of this stuff is going to happen. But, you know, I do think it's good to think through different scenarios as an investor, even if they're not overly pleasant ones. I think it's healthy to think about how you might react. How would your portfolio react? Would you stick with your plan, right? Would your plan still be on track if things went south? I think sort of stress testing your emotions and portfolio can absolutely be a good thing. All right. Instead of us speculating about the what ifs and nightmare scenarios, as interesting as they are to talk about, let's take a break here, and when we come back, we'll be joined by Chuck Self, Chief Investment Officer at iSectors. We'll talk about what's currently going on in the financial markets and what Chuck views as legitimate concerns right now. We'll do that right after break. You're listening to ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate Geraci and Jason Lank in studio. We are now very pleased to be joined by Chuck Self, Chief Investment Officer at iSectors. iSectors is an ETF strategist. They manage a suite of 16 ETF-based asset allocation strategies. These strategies have some $260 million invested in them. And Chuck himself has over 30 years of experience in investment management. Chuck is joining us via phone today from Appleton, Wisconsin. Chuck, great having you back on the program.
Well, thank you, Nate, for having me.
So, Chuck, it's been an interesting year in the financial markets in 2018. For the most part, it's been U.S. stocks and not much else in terms of performance. Obviously, there have been a lot of headlines, trade wars. There's been a lot of politically related headlines. We've seen a flattening of the yield curve. And then I think if you look internationally, no question, emerging markets are experiencing some turmoil. You also have the pending Brexit over in Europe. To begin here, I just want to open it up to you. I'm curious, what's on your radar right now? What gives you the most concern?
Well, it's interesting because, and you know, this program is becoming a little bit of a Debbie Downer with your previous guest comments, and I'm going to add to it. But in any case, it's interesting because trade has been, of course, the headline du jour for the past week. So it's been more than a day. It's been for many days. Our view is that the trade stuff is pretty much baked into the market. If we wouldn't have the trade concerns, the great earnings that we're getting based on, the sugar high we've gotten from the tax cuts, the market would be probably much higher here in the short term. So actually, our major concern is what the Fed is doing, because I learned early on in my investment career not to fight the Fed, and we, you know, there's the talk about the yield curve, and we could talk about that, but people have forgotten also that the balance sheet has been going down, and so we've actually had dual tightening going on, and because the earnings have been good, the market has been supportive, but you know, when the effects of the tax cuts start to fade away, which will be probably next year, we could see some concerns as far as what the market's going to do.
Well, how do you think the Fed is doing in terms of managing the process of removing stimulus and raising rates? Do you think they're on the right track? We actually talked in our previous segment about, if you look back at how they navigated the financial crisis, I think all in all, you have to give them a pretty good grade. What about removing stimulus?
Yeah, I 100% agree that they did a great job. I am not in a camp where people say, "Oh, well, they, unnecessarily propped up the economy or whatever." Without it, the economy would have tanked even more. So, I agree that the Fed should get an A grade for keeping the economy afloat. This is the tricky part, because the Fed wants to normalize. They should want to normalize, because when the next recession comes, they're going to want to be able to decrease interest rates. But, you know, we don't see in our base case, we don't see that inflation is going to be, going too high and being too much of a problem. And we're going to get to the point where, if we're not already there, where the real Fed fund rate is so high that it starts impacting the economy. And then on top of it, the Fed is selling back their bonds that they own, which put pressure on fixed income instruments, keeping rates higher than they would be otherwise. And of course, this gets it to the third horse of the apocalypse, and that is our debt. I just saw something that David Kelly at J.P. Morgan said, that the amount of debt that we owe as a country indirectly through our government, whether it's government bonds, mortgage bonds, whatever, is greater than the debt that we directly own. And it's never been that way. So the debt problem that we're going to have when the economy slows, when interest rates are higher, is my major concern, and I think has not, how many discussions have you seen in the financial press about debt? It's been more about all these other issues, and I think we should be worried about the debt level.
Chuck, this is Jason Lank. Let's remind everyone that the sun is going to come up tomorrow, regardless.
Well, it depends on if you're getting the Carolinas, maybe you don't feel that way. But
exactly. Hey, I want to continue discussion on monetary policy. I just find it fascinating, not just what the Fed is doing, but the worldwide divergence of monetary policy between the major central banks, the Fed, the ECB, and the Japanese central bank. Those other organizations are going in a different direction, or at least not where we're going. There are so many dots you can connect when our interest rates are, potentially rising and others are not. What are some of the ramifications of that?
Well, it's clear that the other countries have to continue to be in a relatively accommodating mode. They don't, again, they don't have the sugar high that we've gotten from our tax cut, and they never recovered to the extent that we did. Now, part of it was their fault, because certainly in the case of Europe, they thought early on in the decade that there was going to be another inflation scare, and they tightened, and, you know, while we were still in an accommodative mode. So now the tables are switched for that. But, you know, the good news for investors, at least, is that the expectations of growth in Europe and in Asia are probably not as high as they should be, which makes international securities, I'm talking about developed market securities, an attractive area to look at, and especially those markets that are not going to be hurt by a rising dollar if the dollar continues to go up.
Well, Chuck, let's talk more about that, because I think as we have seen the U.S. dollar strengthening because of these differing policies among central banks, clearly that's impacted emerging markets.
Yeah.
And it seems like for several years now, there's been a lot of talk about how emerging markets are undervalued, right, or at least more attractively valued than the U.S. and other developed market stocks. But here we are. I know emerging market stocks had a good year in 17, but
right.
we're down now 20% plus from the highs. These markets just seem so tied to the dollar. And then I think you layer on tariffs, the trade wars. Obviously, these countries are predominantly exporters. Is there any light at the end of the tunnel for emerging markets?
Yeah. There is light at the end of the tunnel, and the sun will rise in those countries, too, tomorrow. One of the things, I've been in business for a long time, as you indicated, and I was a bond guy through the 1998 Southeast Asian currency crisis, 1997, I'm sorry, and then the 1998 Russian crisis that had the long-term capital ramifications. And oddly enough, the U.S. economy still kept on going for a couple more years, so that's one point that people should realize. But also, eventually, all these economies recovered, and what is really different this time than 20 years ago is that they were able to issue debt in local currency. Last time, it was pretty much all dollar-denominated currency. The old-timers will remember things called Brady bonds that were U.S. dollar-denominated. So because the debt is in local currency, they don't have as much of an impact with the rising dollar. But the one thing I took away from that we use in our portfolio management is that emerging markets cannot be passively managed. It's a losing strategy. And of course, the reason, especially on the bond side, is obvious. The passively managed emerging market bond portfolio, the biggest debtors are going to have the biggest percentage of your portfolio. And then they're the ones that are more susceptible to the kind of crisis that happened in Turkey and Argentina regularly. So although we are an ETF strategist, we mainly use low-cost passively managed funds. When it comes to emerging markets, you have to have if you're going to play, you got to have an active manager involved, and so that's the one thing I'd love to leave with your audience. Unfortunately, in our analysis, we've not found an active ETF that we can recommend or place our clients' portfolios. So we tend to go to mutual funds in other markets.
Chuck, on that question about ETFs, as a strategist, describe for me your process for locating ETFs. Is there a screen? Are you agnostic to the provider? Do you have relationships with them? What is the relationship between you and the tools you're using?
Yeah, we are completely agnostic. We're completely independent of any provider. We have over 100 ETFs that we're using in our 16 different strategies. You know, multiple ETFs will be used in multiple strategies, and so we don't really care where it comes from. And one of the things that an ETF strategist can do, especially one that's not one of the major behemoths in this field, that other people can't do, is that we can jump on funds while they're small or while they're not very actively trading. So we will at times you'll be one of the early investors in a fund. And so we have a wide range of relationship with at least 15 to 20 different providers where they know us and we know them, and then there's others in which they come up on our risk-based screens, and then we start talking to them. It's just really a lot of blocking and tackling try to find the ones that fit best in our clients' portfolios. But then it's also beyond just finding securities. It's also putting them together in portfolios, and we use a pretty sophisticated holdings-based risk management system that BlackRock has that allows us to do that and make sure that we're not overdoing our risk. It's really interesting. I'll just give you this anecdote. The typical portfolio that a financial advisor will advise is a 60-40 portfolio, right? 60% equity, 40% fixed income. But then when you run it through a risk analysis, it turns out that 85% of the portfolio's risk comes from the equity market. So, your fixed income part is not hardly doing much as far as risk is concerned. So one of the things that's very important, whether it's an individual investor or using an institutional investor, is making sure that the portfolios are truly diversified and have balanced sources of risk.
Our guest is Chuck Self, Chief Investment Officer at iSectors, or an ETF strategist. Chuck, we have a few minutes left here. I want to go back to the economy and specifically the U.S., and I want to talk more about the yield curve. You mentioned your deep background in fixed income. As I'm sure you're well aware, the past 7 or 8 times the yield curve has inverted, that's preceded a recession. Are you concerned with that at all? I hate to use the term, this time could be different. So is that the case? Or are you concerned that the yield curve does in fact invert?
Yeah. Unfortunately, I've been in the business 4 or 5 of those times, so I've seen it happen. And the the academic studies it makes it clear that this is the case, and especially if you look at the inversion of the very longest securities, the 30-year Treasury, and the very shorter security, Fed funds, for instance. And that spread is around 70, so it's not yet at inversion level. But I am not a believer in that this time is different, because the mechanisms that happen when yield curve inverts is still going to happen, and that the banks find it very difficult. The large banks, the New York City banks and the large international banks, all fund themselves in the Fed fund markets. That's how they get the money to lend. And when that money costs more than what they can get from buying securities or lending out securities, that slows down the growth of the economy. I can't tell you. I'm not good enough to be able to say that the next slowdown is going to be a deep recession or shallow recession, or whether it's going to be stagflation. I can't tell you that. But I'm very confident that the combination of the high debt levels, the inverted yield curve, the Fed's slowing or lowering their balance sheet, plus the removal of the positives that have come from the tax cut, will slow down economic growth significantly in 2019 and 20, and probably will lead to a recession in that time frame.
Chuck, we have about 2 minutes left here on this topic of rates, and I guess more specifically fixed income. We've actually spent a lot of time on this show discussing how challenging the environment is for bond investors right now.
Yeah.
And I know you recently launched a new fixed income strategy. Can you maybe first just talk about some of the challenges you see in fixed income, and then just briefly tell us a little bit about the new strategy?
Well, you're exactly correct in that in order to get yields that at all compete with potential equity returns, even much muted ones than the ones that we've had, you've had to take on big amounts of risk. And there are income strategies out there that have done well. But the reason why they've done well is because they've taken a big amount of equity risk. The average mutual fund, income strategy mutual fund, will have about 40% of their portfolio in dividend stocks and 35% of their portfolio in high-yield securities. Well, high-yield bond securities. Well, high-yield bonds are much more correlated with the equity market than they are to the broad fixed income market. So in essence, you have 75% of your portfolio in equities, or at least equity-like securities. And so that's the challenge that investors have had to face. But so as we have gotten a tremendous interest in creating a strategy and now implementing a strategy in that field, one of the things we wanted to do was make sure that we had a truly diversified portfolio where the securities are have low correlations to each other and the equity and fixed income markets. We have to have equity securities in there too. It's about half equities, half fixed income. But the equity securities are high-income infrastructure, MLP, high-dividend stocks. And in the fixed-income securities, we also had to make sure that they were not just all going to go up and down together. So that's what we've done in our strategy. We call it the iSectors Endowment Strategy. Information about it can be found on our website, iSectors.com, or call 800-iSectors, and we'd be happy to talk to investors and financial advisors about the strategy.
Well, Chuck, with that, we'll have to leave it there. Really enjoyed the conversation today. Great having you back on the program. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Nate, and good luck to your listeners. And the sun will rise tomorrow.
Thank you.
Right.
That was Chuck Self, Chief Investment Officer at iSectors. And as Chuck mentioned, you can learn more about their ETF strategies by visiting iSectors.com. Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll be joined by ETF.com's Laura Krieger. We're going to talk pot stocks, which have been on a tear recently. We'll look at some of the drivers and also discuss the ETFMG Alternative Harvest ETF. This is ETF Prime. Welcome back to ETF Prime. Nate and Jason in studio. Let's talk marijuana stocks with ETF.com's Laura Krieger.
Time now for our weekly chat with the experts at ETF.com, the world's leading independent authority on ETFs.
People have been saying there are too many mutual funds since the 80s. For all the talk of smart beta, they haven't pulled in huge assets. The active managers are showing up in the ETF space.
Laura, so the joke right now is investors have moved on from cryptocurrencies and have now taken a fancy to marijuana stocks, which is funny if you think about it, because many people believe Bitcoin is used only to purchase marijuana and other drugs. But in any event, let's start with the ETFMG Alternative Harvest ETF, ticker symbol MJ. This is really the only pure play on marijuana in the ETF space. It's been one of the top performing ETFs over the past month. It's up over 30%. And, you and I actually discussed this topic back in May, and the conversation then was about the lack of performance. So what's changed here?
Yeah, it's been quite a summer for MJ and marijuana stocks in general, hasn't it? Part of that is because we've seen a lot of headlines lately about alcohol makers, big beer sellers and liquor makers. They are throwing their hat into the cannabis ring. So, for whatever reason, beer sales, liquor sales are down or flat. Consumers just aren't buying beer like they used to. So these companies, they see the writing on the wall and they want to get out in front of the next hot new thing, which is marijuana. So, you see alcohol makers like Constellation and Diageo and Molson Coors. They're all either snatching up equity in marijuana companies. In the case of Constellation, they bought a significant stake in Canopy Growth recently. Or these big alcohol makers are shopping around for companies to buy or partner up with, which is the case of Diageo, who's fishing around for companies to partner with on a new marijuana drink venture.
And is that really the key? So for the uninitiated, not that you're an expert, Laura, but is that the play for alcohol companies that they're going to have these THC-infused beverages?
Yeah, absolutely. They are, you know, they're exploring whatever's going to be the next hottest thing to replace. I don't think beer is ever going to be replaced in the consumer's consciousness, right? But, you know, marijuana is certainly becoming the next widely accepted recreational stimulant, or not stimulant, but you know what I mean. So, yeah, they want to get in front of this trend. They see the writing on the wall, as it is.
You know, one thing that I've noticed, I think somewhat interestingly, is tobacco companies have been a bit slow to get involved in marijuana. So we actually had Chris Monaco on the program back in February. His firm, Prime Indexes, manages the index behind MJ. But he actually had one of my favorite lines so far this year. He said, the entire tobacco industry is built on recreational smoking of leaves and paper tubes. So, of course, his point was tobacco companies are really in prime position to capitalize once marijuana is more broadly legalized. Now, I do believe Alliance One bought stakes in a couple of Canadian companies earlier this year. But I guess my question is, overall, why haven't tobacco companies been more aggressive like we've seen with the alcohol companies?
That's a really good question. And I do think tobacco companies are, in general, interested in exploring the marijuana space. But at the same time, they're a little hamstrung. So they are interested in marijuana, but more interested in not pissing off the federal government. So, you know, there were a slew of lawsuits against tobacco in the 60s and 70s. After that, cigarette companies became incredibly regulated, very tightly regulated by the government. And these companies aren't really interested. They're not really eager to go toe-to-toe with the federal government anytime soon again. And lest we forget, marijuana is still federally illegal in the U.S. It's still Schedule I drug, you know, put up there on the same tier as heroin. So they could run afoul very quickly of federal regulators if they got too interested too soon.
Laura, this is Jason Lank. Some of the numbers that are being thrown around here boggle my mind. There's a piece on the website about the volume of sales of marijuana versus cigarettes, and they throw out the number that legal and illegal sales of marijuana are a little over $53 billion in the United States, whereas legal cigarettes, just over $90 billion. So they make the case that total U.S. marijuana sales are already half of U.S. cigarette sales. Is that possible?
I don't see why not. I mean, part of the issue here is that it's hard to track what exactly is being sold and when, because there's no it's still kind of an emerging space, and it is an illegal drug at the federal level. So there is a little bit of opacity into how much is being bought and sold. I don't see why it couldn't be that sort of, you know, levels of buying and selling. Because, you know, the good thing about marijuana, you know, it doesn't give you cancer like cigarettes do, and it doesn't have a lot of calories and, you know, make you drunk in the same way that alcohol does. So, you know, there's a lot of, from a consumer standpoint, I can see why they would want to, you know, there's some benefits to it compared to what's currently on the market. So,
Laura, I have to ask you, one of the holdings in MJ is Scott's Miracle-Gro, which I think always gets some chuckles. But they actually bought one of the top hydroponics distributors earlier this year, right? Hydroponics can be used to help cultivate marijuana crops. I'm just curious, do you have any sense as to how much Scott's is really hanging their hat on marijuana? How big of a piece of their business is this?
It is an exploratory part of their business, right? So they did buy Sunlight Supply, the hydroponics distributor you mentioned. They haven't really seen too much return on investment on that yet. Just this past earnings season, the CEO of Scott's Miracle-Gro had a lot of colorful things to say about their marijuana investments, about the company's marijuana investments. And I quote, dude, those bleeps in the marijuana unit, those bleeps are gun-shy as bleeps right now.
All right, so
not really seeing too much.
if we boil this down, I mean, what's the outlook moving forward? Obviously, there's a lot of buzz and excitement around pot stocks. I personally think it's tough to gauge valuations in this space right now. I think it's just too early, right? There's too much up in the air. So is is this really a regulatory play? Is this just a bet on further legalization?
I do think these alcohol companies that are buying up the marijuana firms, they are treating legalization as kind of a foregone conclusion, which it isn't. I mean, in the long term, yeah, maybe. But in the short term, not so much. We've seen greater movement from the Trump administration to restarting the quote-unquote war on weed. Just this past weekend, there was a story in the Wall Street Journal about how marijuana research applications are just sitting, gathering dust in limbo at the Justice Department. And so, it's not a foregone conclusion that marijuana is going to be legalized at the federal level anytime soon. And I think to an extent there, and not to bring this to a political point, but I do think a lot of what happens next in marijuana, the industry as a whole, is going to hinge on the midterm elections, because a lot of the Democratic candidates have on their platforms explicit calls to legalize marijuana, which, of course, is going to be good for the marijuana industry, whereas a lot of the Republican candidates want to keep on keeping on with the president's agenda. So where this control of Congress shifts at all, if at all, is going to be key to what happens next in the states, whether we are closer or farther from full legalization. And that's really the crux of it. Once you get full legalization, then, for example, the roadblocks holding the tobacco companies back, they fall away. So a lot of dominoes will start tipping very quickly, I think, if we get full legalization in the U.S.
Laura, we only have about 2 minutes left. Briefly circling back to MJ, you and I discussed this back in May, but the CTF now has $500 million invested in it. And I don't want to rehash how the CTF was converted from a prior ETF. I would encourage our listeners to go back and listen to the discussion we had in May. But the question I have is the custodian issue pretty much gone now? Because it just seems hard to imagine U.S. Bank pulling out at this point with $500 million in assets.
Mm-hmm. No, the custodian issue is still there, as far as I can tell. Just nobody really wants to bring too much attention to it. If it weren't a factor, you would see a dozen competing ETFs to MJ that would have launched ages ago. But since nobody can get their custodian bank to custody marijuana stocks specifically for a marijuana ETF, you haven't really seen that happen. I think that people would love for the custodian issue to be resolved. But the SEC has also, this bears mentioning, the SEC recently issued a guidance in one of its Bitcoin ETF rejections, of all things, stating, and I paraphrase here, none of you better try what ETFMG did, what with the switching of the index of an existing fund to track it, in that case, Bitcoin, because we will come after you. We let it slide this once, essentially. It was the unspoken thing, but we're not going to let it slide again. So I don't know. All right. It'll be interesting to see.
60 seconds left. What about the advisor shares VICE ETF, ACT? I'm just curious, any uptake there at all?
Not really. And I think part of that is because ACT is primarily, it's a more than 50% of the fund is an alcohol company. And we're not seeing alcohol companies get the same boost from these big merger deals that marijuana companies are. So, the performance of that fund compared to MJ is pretty piddling. It's only up about 2.5%.
Well, Laura, as always, great chatting. I have a feeling that we're going to be chatting much more about this over the next year or so. This certainly is a topic that is not going away. Appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on.
That was ETF.com's Laura Krieger. I mentioned this earlier. To me, this is really a call option on legalization. I think as you look at just how many companies are getting involved in this space, if you try to get your head around valuations, it's just too difficult. This is a nascent industry. I do think that if we get further legalization, obviously there's a lot of upside, but tough making a call right now.
Absolutely. There is no way to pick the winners and losers yet. The companies that may end up being the winners may not even be formed yet. This is wide open. Inning one of a nine-inning ball game.
Podcasts of ETF Prime are available at etfprime.com, etf.com, Apple iTunes, and you can now find us on Spotify as well. Next week, two excellent guests for you. We'll first be joined by Bloomberg's Eric Balchunas. I always say nobody covers ETFs better than Eric. We'll talk ETF flows, and we might have to do our rapid-fire ETF Q&A with Eric as well. And then we'll also be joined by Josh Rogers, VP Beta Specialist at J.P. Morgan. J.P. Morgan has seen unbelievable flows into their ETFs, their Beta Builders ETFs. So we'll talk about that and some of their other ETFs as well. Until then, have a great week, everyone.